I've hesitated to do this because I realize since the course is being taped, that who knows how long it will be used. It may be used 5-6 years from now. And so I've hesitated making specific recommendations about books to read. But in a way, because he's a friend and because this is a good book, I can hardly resist mentioning this one. And some of you are familiar with it. This is The Cry of the Soul by Dan Allender and Tremper Longman. I know Tremper well. I don't know Dan. But this is a great book, particularly for you guys who are doing the counseling program, in as much as it really shows how, well, the subtitle says, how our emotions reveal our deepest questions about God. And so Dan Allender, a prominent counselor, and Tripper Longman, a prominent Old Testament scholar, combine forces and write a very interesting book. So I think maybe Richard Winter may even use this in one of his courses. Am I right? Some have read. Some say no. Some say yes. I think the answer probably is yes, and you haven't heard, have been exposed to it yet. But I do mention that just as something you may want to read to help bring the Psalms to bear on your specific interest in counseling and even in our struggles with our own emotional lives. Now, we're going to move now to the book of Proverbs. And as I mentioned earlier, we'll go for about 45 minutes and then I'll stop and we'll take a little bit of time to debrief the test that you just took. That will not be on tape, unfortunately, for you guys out there, but your mentor will undoubtedly provide solace and debrief you and so forth. So, book of Proverbs. First, an introductory word, or an introductory question. As you are reading the book of Proverbs, and by the way, don't neglect this week's assignment, which is written over here. Also, don't neglect the fact, and again, I'm sorry for this in terms of the video audience, but we do not meet next week. That's spring break, and it's in the courier. But don't come next week expecting other people to be here. There may be a few, like you, but they shouldn't be here. We meet again in 2 weeks. So that assignment you see there is for 2 weeks from tonight, and that is to complete reading the book of Proverbs, if you haven't already. Complete the book of Proverbs, and also read Matthew's and Benjamin 179 to 198, I think it says, over there, which is that background material. In a rather paraphrastic translation. So you get a sense of what the literary context of the ancient Near East was, out of which the Bible came. Now, obviously, God is the one who inspired the Bible and provided the Bible, but it was not lowered on golden plates. Rather, He inspired it in human language and human literary forms that were present, to some measure at least, at that time. Okay, well, now finally we come to the book of Proverbs. Let me say a word about introduction. As you read the book of Proverbs, what impression do you get? You've read probably, most of you may have read some of it. Of course, you may have been worrying about the midterm, so you said, sufficient to the day is the evil thereof, and I'll worry about Proverbs later. But what impression does it make on you as you're reading it? As you know, when I read something, I try to kind of mentally outline what I'm reading. Maybe I learned that from people who had taken Evelyn Wood's Reading Dynamics. I never took it, but they told me about it. And this idea of kind of outlining in your head as you go along seemed to make sense. How did you find the book of Proverbs? It's in the Bible, if you haven't found it yet. How did you find it? I looked in the table of contents. What is your impression? Does an outline kind of present itself as you're reading the book of Proverbs? Not particularly. At least I got a clear, a forceful answer with conviction. No, not really. Particularly as you get into that central section beginning in chapter 10. Do you ever wish that someone would organize this stuff? And you're aware, of course, that many, many books have done that. Many modern books that you can purchase now organize these Proverbs thematically. And so we sometimes ask ourselves the question, why is the Bible not like that? Well, we're going to have various answers that will happen upon as we discuss the book of Proverbs. But let me begin with a comment by Robert Alden, by the late Robert Alden, a good man, good Old Testament scholar, who died this year actually, but by the time people are watching this out there, it'll be a while later maybe. But he said this in his commentary on the book of Proverbs. He says, the book of Proverbs is like medicine. That's good tasting medicine. He says, you cannot live on medicine alone, but few of us would go through life without some medicine now and then. Well, now maybe some of you stay off of medicine, and so that may not apply. But then he goes on to, I think, a better metaphor. At least we take a vitamin. Likewise, a spiritual diet of Proverbs alone would be most unbalanced. But how sick a person might be, that didn't occasionally ingest some of these potions and antidotes for the sake of his mental, spiritual, and even financial well-being. The book of Proverbs is the kind of biblical fare you should indulge in often, but not in large doses. The stuff of Proverbs has already been distilled so that its advice comes to us in highly concentrated form. These sage tidbits have been boiled down, trimmed, honed, polished, and sharpened to where a little goes a long way. I like that image, that metaphor of a vitamin, but does that help us explain the apparent haphazard arrangement, topical arrangement of the Proverbs that we encounter in much of the book before us? Can that help us in any way? I'm just full of rhetorical questions tonight. Yes, Steve. Okay, within any section you get a broad smattering of topics covered, which is not a bad thing, is it not? What is that like? What kind of vitamin is that like? A multivitamin. Oh, so good. I'm just, I know your brains are dead, so I'm just trying to quicken them. It's like a multivitamin, and so if you're reading a chapter a day, you don't know what challenges you'll face that day. So read a chapter in the book of Proverbs, and you get a little bit of this and a little bit of that, a little vitamin A and a little vitamin E and so forth. And that is helpful. Now, I think there's more to it than that, and we'll come to more to it, but that's a start. And to perhaps acknowledge that this was not a sloppily arranged book. I think we'll see that it's more ingeniously arranged than we ever realized. But at least for starters, we can say, yeah, there is a sense, a kind of a multivitamin sense to the skipping from topic to topic to topic and then another topic. And so while we have room for these books that group them together topically, that may not be the best way to read the book of Proverbs, because you may read all about your perspective on wealth one day and not see any wealth for some good long time, whereas you may be having real trouble with your temper and not get around to reading that section until later. But you can't read too many chapters in Proverbs without both of those being addressed. Now, let's move on to the question of authorship. Well, who's the author of the book of Proverbs? Solomon. Okay, good. There are actually two other authors named. Did you realize that? Well, Hezekiah, in chapter 25, at the beginning of Proverbs chapter 25, we read not so much that Hezekiah was the author, but we read this in the NIV translation: "These are more proverbs of Solomon, copied by the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah." So there we get the impression that there was Solomonic material that had not yet found its place in the book of Proverbs, and during the reign of Hezekiah, 2 centuries after Solomon, or approximately 2 centuries after Solomon, it was deemed appropriate to include that Solomonic material in this book. I think I mentioned that earlier when we were talking about the way some of these Old Testament books did not take shape in a day, or even in a month, or even in a year, but sometimes over a span of, as we see here, centuries. Solomonic material retained and then incorporated in the time of Hezekiah. But there are two other authors actually named. Yeah, Agur. Who in the world is that? Well, we're not sure. But he's mentioned at the beginning of chapter 30. And then Lemuel, King Lemuel. And where did he get his wisdom? From his mother. Let that be a lesson to you. Okay? Mothers have much wisdom to impart. So those three are named explicitly. And there may be others. Nevertheless, if you have to choose one, surely Solomon is the creative genius. He is the prime author of this book. Yes, question in the back. Right, well, the question is, when the men of Hezekiah incorporated Solomonic material into the book, was that Solomonic material available to them in written form or as perhaps oral tradition? We have no way of knowing. There's absolutely no way to know that. It is true that the ancients and some moderns were far more capable of retaining things just as oral tradition than we are. I can hardly remember, to put my left shoe on having just put my right shoe on unless I have a note. It says, you've done one shoe, do the other. It's part of the profession of being a professor. It goes along with the territory. But there are other people and places and cultures where it's incredible how much can be retained that they just take in orally. They don't take any notes on it. And yet they can retain it. We had this experience, my wife and I had this experience a couple of years ago during the summer when we were in Uganda. And we were speaking at a women's conference where many of the women, probably half the women were literate and could read and write. About half of them couldn't. But even those who could read and write didn't have much by way of writing materials. There were some, but just not much. It was a very poor area. And so I gave one talk one day, and then my wife got up the next day to give a talk, and she wanted to kind of tie into something that I had said, and so she started to reiterate and to describe again what I had said. And they basically kind of nodded their head and said, "Yeah, he said that yesterday. We haven't forgotten that. Move on. You know, you don't need to tell us again." And I think, wow, of all the things, because they were having about probably 4 or 5 hours a day where they were just sitting there, and they were taking all that in and logging it away and remembering it. And it's a facility that we can learn and we can train, but also one that we can lose. I shouldn't get into too many anecdotes, but one other. I had a friend when I was doing some study in Heidelberg, happened to be a Mormon young man, but he didn't take notes in Akkadian class, in Assyrian class. And I thought, why are you not taking notes? And he said, because I'm trying to train my mind, and I've noticed that if I take notes, I think, okay, I can go back and learn that later. But if I don't take notes, I say, you know, it increases the intensity. And I say, I've got to remember that because I'm not taking a note. I dare not forget that. Now, I don't know if it worked. I left. I don't know if he flunked out, but he may have. And if you're not taking notes ever, don't come up to me and say, I'm training my mind, you know, because I bought it from him. I won't buy it from you. At any rate, so in a long answer to that question, we don't know, Matt, whether they had written tradition before them or not. If I had to speculate, I would say that it's likely that there was some written record of this Solomonic material, but had not been included to that day. In other words, Solomon himself, in his own formation of his collection, had chosen from his... How many Proverbs did Solomon write? 1 Kings 4? Anyone read that recently? 1 Kings 4... It says 3,000, 432, 1 Kings 4:32. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. Wow, so not a round number there in terms of the songs. So among the 3,000, we'll talk about how many he actually included. It's very interesting to count up how many he included in his own collection. Okay, so authorship, we can say, I would say, and by the way, not every scholar would agree with this, but I believe that Solomon is the fountainhead of the book of Proverbs and the primary author there, although there are other authors mentioned and possibly others that are not mentioned. Structure and content. Well, we want to spend a lot of time with the content of the book of Proverbs and really allow some of these sage tidbits to become part of the fabric of the way we think. But let me just give you a brief overview. If you look at your outline, just both pages very quickly, you can kind of get a sense that there are some natural titles that occur in the psalm. And that's the way I formulated this outline. In fact, there are 7 headings in the book that seem to be inherent divisions in the book. And they are, the first heading and the last heading can nicely be subdivided into 2 subsections. But other than that, in italics on your outline, you have those 7 headings. The first heading is the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. The second comes in chapter 10, verse 1, the Proverbs of Solomon. The third in 22:17, pay attention and listen to the sayings of the wise. And then again, 24:23, these also are sayings of the wise. Now you ask, why? I mean, if we're continuing sayings of the wise, why another heading? We'll see that there was a reason for that when we get there. Chapter 25, verse 1 that we've been discussing, these are more Proverbs of Solomon copied by the men of Hezekiah, king of Judah. And in Proverbs 30, verse 1, the sayings of Agur, son of Jakeh, an oracle. A lot of translation questions on that particular one. And Proverbs 31, verse 1, the sayings of King Lemuel, an oracle his mother taught him. And then that subdivides into the words of King Lemuel. And then the acrostic of the ideal wife. Wife used in the Old English sense of a woman or a wife, a worthy woman. Same way that the word Frau in German is used to mean both wife and woman, either or both. Now, well, let's go back and look at the first section, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. In the first 7 verses, like many ancient Near Eastern wisdom books, we have first a title and then a statement of the purpose of the book. So let's look back and read those first 7 verses and get a sense of what this book is all about. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. Here comes the purpose. For attaining wisdom and discipline, for understanding words of insight, for acquiring a disciplined and prudent life, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to the simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance for understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. So here we have a title, then a statement of purpose, including an exhortation. You notice that in verse 5. Let the wise listen. Notice verse 4 mentions the simple. This is for giving prudence to the simple. And yet this is a book not just for the simple. This is a book that is pertinent to the wisest of people. Let the wise listen and add to their learning, and let the discerning get guidance. So the book begins with the title, the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. Now, some have questioned whether this title applies to the whole book, as kind of a generalized title for the whole book, or to the first 9 chapters, because we get another title in chapter 10, verse 1. Does anyone recall what Derek Kidner, what his view is on this? Now, again, I know you realize you weren't being tested on those chapters in Kidner, so you may have deferred that pleasure until spring break. Anyone remember? Derek Kidner, yes, I see those hands. Derek Kidner, it's just for the video audience, you know, to make you guys look good. Well, Derek Kidner opts for the latter approach, and that is to say that this title applies to the whole book. And his argument is this. He says, otherwise we would expect the first verse of chapter 10, which says the Proverbs of Solomon, we would expect it to read, these also are Proverbs of Solomon. We later, you know, when we run into the sayings of the wise, remember one of those sections after the sayings of the wise in 22:17 and following, then we have Proverbs 24:23. These also are sayings of the wise. And Kidner's point is, well, if the first 9 chapters are written by Solomon, then we would expect chapter 10 to say these also are Proverbs of Solomon. Well, you know, that's not an absolutely ironclad argument. And it might be worth recognizing, too, I have an immense regard for Derek Kidner's opinion, so I'm just putting in my 2 bits here. It is also true that the first 9 chapters have sort of a hortatory, or there's not one of those weird words. They are exhortations. They're exhorting, as the father is saying, listen, my son, to your father's instructions, and do not neglect your mother's teaching. Okay, and he's exhorting his son. Whereas when we get to chapter 10, then we get more what we expect when we think of the of a proverb or a saying, a snappy little pithy wise saying. Whereas the first 9 chapters are not so much in the genre of proverbs as they are more paragraph length exhortations to choose wisdom over folly. So it may be that we don't really need to decide between, and we can say, yeah, the first verse of chapter 1 does apply to the whole book, but that would not necessarily mean that the first 9 chapters could not have been written by Solomon. Many commentaries would assume that they weren't, but often for wrong reasons, such as that they're not short and brief, but they're longer and more elaborate. I talked about that earlier, that's a poor criterion for dating documents. Because we now have ancient Near Eastern wisdom literature that antedates, it comes before Solomon by about 1,500 years, that is very long and elaborate and discursive. So this shouldn't surprise us to find this here. Well, what is the purpose then? Well, the purpose is for attaining wisdom, discipline, for understanding words of insight, etc., etc. He really rings the changes, uses about all the synonyms he can think of to suggest what a person can gain from reading this book. Norman Wybrey, in his commentary, puts it this way. He said verses 2 to 6 suggest that, quote, those who attend to them will receive a comprehensive set of intellectual and moral qualities. Comprehensive set of intellectual and moral qualities. It's sort of this is what you need to get by in life and to get by well. But notice that the key verse, that which becomes the motto not only for the book of Proverbs but for the wisdom literature in general, comes in verse 7. Wybrey acknowledges this as well. He says the most important point however, is made in verse 7. It's the first principle. It's the motto of wisdom literature. It's repeated in Proverbs 9:10. How does Proverbs 9:10 go? The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. Okay? Fear of the Lord, and remember that knowledge can mean acknowledgement. Knowing Him and also acknowledging Him is understanding. Okay? That is the quintessential point. It was made also in Psalm 111, verse 10. We've seen that several times. I want to make sure that this gets ingrained, because if you learn nothing else, if you can learn this fundamental principle, as it's stated in Psalm 111, 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. All who follow His precepts have good understanding. The reason I like that verse in particular also is that it combines an attitude and a respectful awe toward God with action. NIV says, all who follow His precepts have good understanding. The Hebrew says, wise understanding are those who do them. You know, don't be just a hearer of the word, be a doer also. That's Psalm 111, verse 10. So over and over in the wisdom books, particularly in the book of Proverbs, but even in Job 28, 28, we will have this motto repeated. And that should undergird everything we think about when we think about the practicalities of life. Norman Ryberry goes on to say, the reader will see all the book's teaching as, after this introduction, the reader will then be in a position to see all the book's teaching as directed towards the formation of the complete person, both wise and pious, pious in a good sense, wise because pious and pious because wise. It makes all kinds of sense, if God is truly God, that we make Him the focal point of our attention, and that we recognize that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. He says this: the whole book is pushing toward the formation of the complete person. Now, does that speak to us at all today? Are there any broken people around today? Any incomplete people? Any uncentered people? Do we get uncentered or decentered? I know we're always trying to get centered. Yeah, I mean, we live in a dysfunctional world. We have problems with dysfunctional families. We have dysfunctional personalities. We have all kinds of problems. And I'm not saying they're easy answers, but I say there is an answer that begins with fear of the Lord. The beginning of wisdom. The beginning of completion. The beginning of healing. Now, some of that healing takes a long time. It takes a number of different kinds of treatments to be healed. But God is at the center of that, and He is the one who will make it complete, if not in this lifetime, then in the next. Ray Van Leeuwen, who's done a lot of work, good evangelical scholar, who's done a lot of work on the book of Proverbs, has a very interesting article, and I wish I'd brought the book so I could show it to you and recommend his essay to you. It's in Leland Ryken and Trimper Longman's Complete Literary Guide to the Bible. It's in your syllabus on your reading list. Ray Van Leeuwen has written the essay on Proverbs, and he has this to say about this introductory section. He says, and there's a lot packed into these words, so listen carefully to them. Here God and humans, wisdom and folly, knowledge and sweat born of parental urging, are related in the tight space of 8 Hebrew words. He's referring to verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline. Only 8 words in Hebrew. Packed into that are all these things. Life is caught between the pull of God and the good, and the pull toward folly and pseudo-good. Faith is not opposed to reason, but constitutes its possibility, its connection to reality, alluding to von Rad's words. More, the word beginning contains the hint, to be elaborated throughout the first 9 chapters, that life is not static, but a journey whose end is found in its beginning. They're alluding to words of T.S. Eliot. Let me repeat 2 of those, because I think they're important. Faith is not opposed to reason, but constitutes its possibility, its connection to reality. Sometimes in our world, people look at those who embrace faith as dreamers. You know, come on, let's be honest, let's be realists. Let's not have this belief in pie in the sky by and by, that kind of faith that divorces you from reality. Well, the point that's being made here is faith is not opposed to reason, but constitutes its possibility, its connection to reality. If God is really there, then to act and think as if He is not is the height of irrationality. That's the dream world that doesn't recognize that God is there and God is sovereign. So those who deny that, if we're right as theists, and I believe we are, and there's all kinds of evidence to suggest that we are, in addition to God's own claims that we are, if God is there, then to act and live as if He is not is to live in a dream world. So believers are not the dreamers. It's the unbelievers who are in for a rude awakening. They will be the ones who will awaken as out of sleep. So very important. Faith in God, putting Him in the center, is not to become less practical. It's to become real. That's the way the real world lives, real world exists. And then I loved what he said there at the end. The word beginning contains the hint to be elaborated throughout the first 9 chapters that life is not static, but a journey whose end is found in its beginning. The end of our lives is found in its beginning. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. How do we hope that we grow over time? I hope my love and my understanding and my fear and my knowledge and my acknowledgement of God grows from day to day and week to week and year to year. That's where it begins. Until I've begun there, I haven't taken the first step in real wisdom. Now, I could be very clever. I could have lots of intelligence. And I could be very, very dangerous if I haven't taken the first step in real wisdom. And I could also be very miserable. Well, after this introduction and the motto, we'll move now to the next set of chapters, and we'll survey them more briefly. First, a question. Yes? The last person I was quoting was... that's a name I should probably write on the board, shouldn't I? It's Ray... I better make sure I spell his name right. It's one of those Dutch names, and he would never forgive me. I think that's right. Ray van Leeuwen. Leeuwen. Hey, good. We have a debate among an Afrikaans and a Dutch speaker here, and let's see. What do you say? Leeuwen. And what do you say? Leeuwen. That's pretty close. You can fight about it at the break. It's pretty good. All right. I don't know how he says, and he probably has no say anyway. It doesn't matter. All right, well, let's move on and now look at... Obviously, we're going to move quickly over some of this and then pause and look at themes. What these first 9 chapters do is they provide a necessary orientation. Where you do get these paragraph-length discussions, they provide a little treatise on certain focal points, certain topics, that then will be touched upon much more briefly in those little sentence sayings. So this gives us a very good orientation for understanding when we just have, here's a saying here or a saying there. And without context, it might be a little bit hard to understand what's being said. This provides that context. So we get an introduction here into these very important themes. And what I'd like to do, and this will spill over into next time, is just talk about certain ones of those themes, have us think about them, have us look at them, and trace them through a short passage to see what the... What some of the major points the book will be making are. Well, first thing we notice right off the bat in verse 8 of chapter 1 is that wisdom begins in the home. Listen, my son, to your father's instruction. Or turn over to chapter 6, verse 20, just so it doesn't leave out mothers. My son, keep your father's commands and do not forsake your mother's teaching. That's chapter 6, verse 20. My son, keep your father's commands and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Now, both parents are involved in the instruction of children. Who is addressed here, however? Sons. Does that mean that daughters were not worthy of address? No. Good answer. No. That does not mean that daughters were not worthy of address. Is it important, however, to recognize that the addressees of the book of Proverbs are the sons? It's kind of, maybe it's like a boys' school. We don't know exactly what the setting was. Why would that be important? This is kind of a brain teaser. Think about some of the content of the book of Proverbs, and can you think of a reason why it's important for us to recognize at the outset that sons are being addressed here? Now, granted, a teacher can refer to his pupils as my sons. And sometimes, especially in the olden days, someone would stand up and address a group like this as brethren. And in the olden days, women would not have felt so affronted as they might nowadays. I'm not a brother. But I do think it's important to recognize that that sons are being addressed. By implication, of course, daughters. But why would I say that's important? I read recently an essay that's going to come out in a magazine sometime soon on the attempt of the NIV to gender neutralize the text. And by the time you're watching this on video out there in TV land, it will have been done, I imagine. Well, it might, yeah. The response is, does it have something to do with the culture? Well, yes, I think certainly this is some kind of context in which there was a group of sons or a son in a home. And, yeah, because it's singular. Listen, my son, and the father is training his son. Now, again, I would assume that daughters were trained. Daughters were to be as godly as sons. But this happens to be addressing sons. What? Maybe I should put it this way. What trouble are we going to run into if we gender neutralize the language? Oh, Todd, he just put his hand down. Go ahead and make your comment, and I'll come back to that question. Right. Okay, we're the learner, so it's spoken as to sons, and we can consider ourselves, okay, we're children, we're here to learn. Good. Yeah, Terry? Right. Yeah, I mean, as we read the text to our children, I can't remember if I may have alluded to this even in this class at some point, but reading to them about this issue, I see Rye smiles, I probably went on at great length about this at some point, they ask, what about adulterous men? You know? And if we gender neutralize the language so it appears to be just addressing children in general, and then only go on about the wiles of the wayward woman and the adulterous woman, it begins to sound like, wow, women were really bad, and as children needed to be warned of bad women, but don't mention any bad men. Now that would be a mistake. Yeah, Sandra. Well, right, yeah, I mean, there's a lot that is taught implicitly. If you, my sons, are to stay clear of the wayward woman and the adulterous woman, well, that would imply something about your own behavior as well. And that you should not be a trap, and misbehavior will lead to the same things in your regard as it does with the wayward woman. Well, let's look at another thing. Sometimes we hear about retributive justice. The thing I don't like about retributive justice is it sounds, retribution is a negative term in our mind. What I like to talk about is causal justice or causative justice, that our actions do have repercussions. They do have consequences. Look at chapter 2, beginning in verse 21. For the upright will live in the land, and the blameless will remain in it. But the wicked will be cut off from the land, and the unfaithful will be torn from it. Action, consequence. Righteous, the upright will live in the land. The wicked will be cut off from it. Or look at chapter 3, beginning in verse 33 to 35. The Lord's curse is on the house of the wicked, but he blesses the home of the righteous. He mocks proud mockers, but gives grace to the humble. The wise inherit honor, but fools he holds up to shame. Okay, over and again. The righteous, the wicked. The wise, the fools. Their actions have consequences. Our actions have consequences. A very fundamental principle of life. Not to be obscured by our rightful understanding of grace, that it's you know, that our behavior does not accrue merit with God. God is never beholden to us. We do not make ourselves His children by being good. Nevertheless, as His children, again, as I've said in this class before, and as our Father, in relation to us, He gives us wise instruction, and in following them there is blessing. Again, He doesn't owe us blessing, but in the general sense in which we take the Proverbs, it's good for us to heed a father's instruction. So, causative justice, the sense, the intelligibility of the universe, we'll talk about that later when we debrief, the ultimate intelligibility of the universe means that actions do have consequences. Another theme, and this is a very important theme, and that is the limitations of human understanding. Maybe that ties in well with the, in principle, intelligibility of the universe. And yet we as human beings are limited in our understanding. One of the couple of verses we've memorized, Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, say, okay, no telling what they're going to dub in over your lips when they're taking that there. Good, and I didn't need to say that for the video audience because they know it by now, and if they don't, they should. So they should have been saying it right along. man is limited, and the book of Proverbs, which is intent on imparting wisdom, on giving instruction, on the simple gaining understanding, on the wise adding to their understanding, nevertheless says, you can push it this far, but you'll never know it all. It will never be sufficient. So don't lean on your own understanding. Don't think that you've got enough. Another verse that comes toward the end of the book, chapter 22, verse 19. I love this one. At the beginning of the sayings of the wise, that first set of sayings, one of the major sections that's introduced in verse 17. Then in verse 19 it says, so that your trust may be in the Lord, I teach you today, even you. I want you to learn all you can so that you will come to the end of your own understanding. And this is 22, verse 19. I want you to come to the end of your own understanding and realize there's more that you will not be able to fathom. God's thoughts are higher than your thoughts. Don't lean on your own understanding. Don't think you're wise enough to fail, to cease, to depend on Him. Another section that deals with that are those famous words of Lemuel, chapter 30. Beginning in verse 1, the sayings of Agur, son of Jakeh, an oracle. This man declared to Ithiel, and to Ukal. Oh, brother. That, again, is a very controverted translation problem there. But he goes on to say, I am the most ignorant of men. I do not have a man's understanding. I have not learned wisdom, nor have I knowledge of the Holy One. Who has gone up to heaven and come down? Who has gathered up the wind in the hollow of his hands? Who has wrapped up the waters in his cloak? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name and the name of his son? Tell me if you know. And then he says, or someone says, every word of God is flawless. He is a shield to those who take refuge in him. Do not add to his words, or he will rebuke you and prove you a liar. So, contrasting ignorance, the self-avowed ignorance, we come then face to face with the flawless Word of God. Now speak of sometimes as psychosomatic illness. Did you notice that in reading through? Now again, I'm not a physician nor a counselor, so I'm not an expert in I'm pretty good at psychosis, but psychosomatic. What is it? Yeah, okay, he's got to do it in two words. I was trying to think of one word that pulled it together and made it harder. Well, anyway, look at an example. Look at chapter 4. And you kind of have to take them cumulatively because chapter 4 beginning in verse 20, some of them you could say, well, this is just metaphoric language and certain sense. And in Hebrew, the word lev, which means heart, means the very center of a person's being, including his mind, his cognitive faculties. It's not just the seat of the emotions, but it's the center of the entire being. So he's saying, guard your center, guard your mind, guard your heart, for it is the wellspring of life. What you allow in is what you become. I know there's a New Testament verse that says it's not what goes into a man that defiles a man, but you need to read on because it says, for it goes into his stomach. But then it goes on to talk about, but guard your heart. So that very verse that's sometimes claimed to justify all kinds of intake. You know, I can walk here, there in the world and take in all kinds of stuff, and it's not what goes into me that defiles me. Oh, if it goes into your heart, that is your center, your mind, the way you think, the way you feel, that can hurt you. It's all foods are clean, but not everything else. And it's an important thing to recognize. What goes in and is in our heart, not only is a wellspring of life, but it's health or lack of health to a whole man's body. Now, I know that's metaphorical language, but let's move on and see some others. I think cumulatively we get the idea that there was a clear understanding or something of an understanding of the relationship between the mind, the spirit, the inner life of human beings, and their physical condition. I'm not saying, you know, go away and concentrate and meditate and heal yourself either. But let's see what the book of Proverbs says. Chapter 3, verse 8. And I'm going to just read several of these without comment and then summarize. Chapter 3, verse 8. This will bring health to your body. Well, maybe I better begin in 7. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and shun evil. This will bring health to your body and nourishment to your bones. Now look at chapter 15, verse 30. A cheerful look brings joy to the heart, and good news gives health to the bones. 16:24. Can you keep up? 16:24. Pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. That's a good, I said I wasn't going to comment, but that's a good one to remember. Sometimes I remember seeing a videotape series years ago in which I think it was Gary Smalley was talking about how we punch holes in one another and drain each other's energy. You know, and I think it was on that videotape series in which he said, you know, with your family, you should treat your family as strangers. Now, because sometimes we usually treat strangers civilly, at least. I'm not sure my teenage son always does, but I'm trying to train him to do that. But we normally treat strangers civilly, and sometimes we're not even civil to our family members. Maybe we should think about this one. Pleasant words are a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and healing to the bones. It's amazing how we can heal one another through a kind word, a kind act. Chapter 17, verse 22. A cheerful heart is good medicine, but a bruised spirit dries up the bones. We've been talking about health to the bones. Now we're talking about how a cheerful heart is good medicine. I don't think those kinds of words would be used if they were only being used metaphorically. I think it's saying, you know, that we can, the way our emotional life can drain us physically, and on the other hand, a cheerful heart, a heart that is whole before God and is trusting in God, can energize us. Again, I'm not talking about self-healing in any kind of New Age sense or anything, but I do think that there is this holistic sense that there is a relationship between our emotional lives and the condition of our bodies. One more, chapter 18, verse 14. A man's spirit sustains him in sickness, but a crushed spirit who can bear? A man's spirit sustains him in sickness. Doesn't necessarily heal him immediately, but it does sustain him through that. Well, these are just a few. We're going to go on and talk about next time many other themes such as teachability and sin's double cross and a number of things, and then move into these other sections of the book of Proverbs. We're not absolutely done because I do want to debrief you a little bit. If you're interested on the exam, if you're not, we can all go home early.